Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact. This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Hi, it's Jonathan Goldhill, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. There are countless books, seminars, and consultants that offer the secrets to everlasting business success. After heeding their advice, perhaps you manage your time more efficiently, write a compelling pitch letter, or close a few more deals. But after a week or a month, you revert to old bad habits and mediocre performance until the next hot program comes along. The only lasting way to enhance your productivity and growth is to focus on a handful of basic concepts and repeat them week after week, and teach your staff to do the same. The Ultimate Sales Machine, one of the best-selling business books of all time, was first published in 2007 by legendary sales expert Chet Holmes. In this book, he explained how to tune up virtually every area of your business systematically with just a little disciplined focus. All you needed was to focus on 12 key areas of improvement and practice them over and over with pig-headed discipline. My guest today is Chet Holmes' daughter, Amanda Holmes. Amanda Holmes breathed new life into her father's classic advice by adding new content and adjusting it to today's environment. Amanda is the CEO of Chet Holmes International, which has worked with over 250,000 businesses worldwide. At age 24, she inherited her father's multimillion dollar enterprise, which specialized in helping companies double their sales. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
All right. Let's start off with that letter. Everyone's talking about the foreword, Dear Dad. I hear it's made some men, grown men, I should say, cry. And I can tell you, for one, I am one of those. I cried when I read that letter. And that is what had me reach out to you. Of course, I'm very familiar with the book. I read it long after I had read many other business books, but it seemed like the Bible for sales, for marketing, for time management. And can you tell us about what you wrote then?
So I inherited the business with no real succession plan, which was a bit crazy considering my father was diagnosed with cancer 11 years ago. And he spent 352 nights there, and never once a night alone. So it was between me, my mother, and my brother. So I spent easily 100 all-nighters with him. And yet he never sat me down and said, Amanda, here are my businesses. Here's who runs my businesses. Here's what I'd like to see for my businesses. We never had that dialogue. After he passed, which I was very close with him, so it was utterly devastating for me. He was my hero. After he passed, then they didn't know what to do with me, a couple hundred staff. So they made me chairwoman of the board. And I didn't really want to be there. They didn't really want me there, but we were just stuck in this situation. And the only way that I really learned my father's business was just like all of our clients. I watched his videos over and over again. I read his book over and over again. And I read his emails. And one night before the manuscript was due, I wrote the new edition of my father's book. took me 4 years. So one night I found this email where he said that he had generated more wealth in the last 6 months than the prior 8 years combined. And it was because of this one thing. And I went, I've hit gold. This is it. So I called it the encore my father never got to give on how to live a rich and full life. Because in the last year or so of his life, he really changed his modus operandi, just how he viewed the world and his purpose in it and how to be more at peace, because my father was extremely driven. So when I first inherited the company, I thought, I don't want to just bury myself in an early grave right next to my father right at 55. Why would I want that same fate? I watched him go through it. Thankfully, I had a mentor who's an Indian saint. I call her Guruji. She's the founder of Divine Bliss International. And she was the one that said, you could step in and you can be CEO. And I'd look at her like, you've got to be kidding me. I was a singer-songwriter prior. So just released my fourth record. I was touring. I'd gone to music school. She's like, yes, you can step in as CEO. And she said, but you can do it differently. You can approach it differently. And what she taught me was the same thing I found in the letter. And so when I first stepped in as CEO, I started running webinars where I would sell. It would be me. I'm 26 years old. I have 400 CEOs in the room and I'd be teaching you how to double your sales, right? It was, I don't know where I got the best to do this. It was insane. One day I had finished a webinar and I didn't sell anything at the end of the webinar. And I was a bit down and I saw my guru and I bowed and I said, hello. And she's like, you seem sad. I'm like, oh no, I'm okay. She's like, no, what's wrong? And I said, I just did a webinar and I didn't close any business. And she went, close. She's an enlightened being. It's not like she really knows the sales vernacular. I'm like, close like a vice. You win their business. And she looked at me like, why would you ever want to put pressure on somebody? To put pressure on them means you're putting pressure on yourself. And pressure steals the pleasure from life. Why wouldn't you, with all those people on a call, why wouldn't you put a seed in the ground and let it bloom? And when you put that seed and let it grow, you have enough people to build an orchard. And then when you look at that tree to grab the fruit, you could approach it in one of two ways. You could either go up, take an axe, and with force and pressure and anger and manipulation, you could cut off a whole tree branch just to grab that one piece of fruit. Or you could look at a tree and be so grateful that it has such a beautiful bounty. You could be humbled by its beauty and then lovingly pluck an apple. So then you have two apples. Both you have gotten the apple, but one was in anger and pressure and the other one was in humbleness and gratitude. And that one that's in gratitude will be the sweetest apple you've ever tasted, but the one in pressure will steal the sweetness from every bite. So I found that metaphor that my guru gave me, something clicked in my head. And after that, we doubled our clients multiple years in a row. I increased our conversion rates by 1,100%. I increased our leads by 1,176%. It completely shifted me from feeling I needed to do things in pressure and manipulation into I can just be me and enjoy myself and be humbled and grateful for the opportunity to serve. And that was exactly what I found in the letter that my father had written about how he generated more wealth in 6 months than the prior 8 years combined.
That's amazing. What a beautiful story and how it's come full circle. And let me just back up. What was it like to grow up the daughter of Chet Holmes? And did you have other siblings? And so tell us a little bit about that childhood.
Yeah, I have a brother. He wasn't really interested in the business so much. Brilliant. I tried to get him so many times. I think he worked for us for a couple of months and he wrote some of our most successful campaigns. He's a storyteller like my father and a brilliant writer. But I couldn't keep him in the business.
But you had that creative spark being a singer-songwriter, recording albums. And what was it that led you to want to step up and step into this role?
My father, he had always wanted to be a director and a movie producer. So he wrote several screenplays, sold one to Warner Brothers. He recorded an independent film. We put on a play in Hollywood. That was his dream, was to be, create movies. And he wrote thousands of campaigns for the Fortune 500. And he was so prolific in marketing and sales. He just was so good at that. It was hard for him to leave it. So he said, that he sacrificed his life and he worked so hard so that me and my brother could do whatever we wanted, whatever we'd like to do. And he was so passionate about the arts. My brother at one point had become a writer and an actor. And then I went into singing because he'd also written hundreds of songs with his best friend. So he supported us in our passions. So there was never really the talk of either of us would be a part of the business. Yeah.
And you were the younger in the birth order, I take it.
No, I'm older.
Oh, okay. So tell us a little bit about the moment of transition and the handoff. Did your brother step up at that same time that you stepped up, or obvious that you like, I got to keep this going? What was it? What was that experience?
I hired and fired four different CEOs, a president, a CFO, a CMO, a CTO, all just trying to fill the void of my father. It's a personality brand, Chet Holmes International, right? It's not as if he was in the day-to-day. He hadn't been for years, but it was as if it was a body and all these moving parts. And without my father, it was missing the heart. So none of the parts felt like they could work anymore because it was missing him. Mm. And my guru just kept telling me that I could step in. And I really thought that she was bonkers. And I just kept trying to pull in all of these other people. I think the changing moment was one of my staff said, I'm climbing Kilimanjaro next week. I think you'd really like it. Would you like to go? And I looked at him like, yeah, maybe. When are you leaving? And this was on Thursday. And he's like, I leave on Monday for Africa. And I was like, okay, how much time would I have to tell you if I'm going to go or not? He's like, I would need to know in 24 hours. I didn't realize later on, I found out that he was joking. He didn't actually think I'd say yes. And then I said yes. So then I went and climbed the largest freestanding mountain with 72 hours notice. And he was
no prior training. Okay. That's great.
But I worked out a lot, but as I started, I realized, I don't know if much about altitude sickness, but people smoke. Oh, you do?
Yeah, sure. I'm a skier, so I know altitudes.
Okay. So what I didn't know, so I worked out a ton, but what I didn't know is that smokers have a much easier time in altitude because they're used to restricted breath. Okay. Whereas me, I'm a trained vocalist. So breath for me, I've studied this at that point, it had been 15 years of vocal lessons and I'd just gone through my yoga teacher training. So I breathe much deeper than the average person. So when I got there, I was devastated on day one. Like I had such a hard time, headaches and nausea.
Interesting.
And and I barely made it to the top. And that's a whole story in itself. But after that, I realized that things that feel completely insurmountable and impossible can be achieved just one step at a time. And then I also realized that I couldn't do it alone. There was about, on the day of summit, everyone had left and it was just me and one African man on my left and one African man on my right so that I wouldn't fall down the mountain. And my eyes were rolling to the back of my head and I couldn't really control my body. And I realized that I never would have been able to summit without the help of others. And I realized that I would never be able to take over the company without help of others. And to be grateful and humble enough to accept the help from others, because there's plenty of staff around, I just needed to lean on them. And I had never really leaned on others before. I'd always just been a rogue one woman army. That metaphor really helped me come back. And I was like, okay, let's do it. So I let go of the current CEO and I stepped into CEO. And that week, man, everything went wrong. I got served papers for a lawsuit. My CFO came to me and said that we were in transition. We'd spent $500,000 on Salesforce, but he didn't think that it was a good time to go into Salesforce. So we should just cancel that contract and just stay without a CRM or go back to our old CRM. And then that same week as well, the merchant servicer shut down my account. So I couldn't pay the hundreds of staff. And I'm like, what's a merchant service company? I didn't know what a CRM was when they was asking me, should we go to the CRM or not? I was in over my head, but I had just climbed Kilimanjaro.
Amazing.
What it's worth. And here we are 8 years later. I've been CEO for 8 years.
Incredible. And do you see yourself more in the visionary role or in the integrator role, to use terms that popular with EOS, you're probably familiar with?
Yes.
Which role are you? Which hat do you wear?
I'm similar to my father in like the visionary. I love to innovate. And that's what I spent the last 4 years working on with the new edition of my father's book. So my father came out with all these concepts before the internet. He was so before his time. And he was teaching, he was doing content marketing from radio ads.
Right.
Nobody was doing that at that time. So I had to reinvent everything that he did. It's all the same strategies. Those are timeless. It's just the tactical implementation of them. So what he did on radio, I've proven in Facebook ads. And what he did on fax machines, I'm doing in Instagram DMs. What he did on voicemails, I'm doing on ringless voicemails. So all of the concepts are still the same. It's just the tactical shift that needed to be implemented. So I'm definitely more of the visionary, and I surround myself by integrators so that we can get the visions into paper and into dollar signs.
That's amazing. Yeah. He reminds me of people from a different era, Dan Kennedy, Bill Glazer, the direct marketing sales letters that were all too popular back then. Yes. So, all right, let's talk about the strategies. There used to be only 7 different marketing mediums 10 years ago that companies would deploy. Today, it's double that with 13 different marketing mediums. We're doing double the work for a fraction of the results. So what's changed over the last 10, 15 years that we should know to assist us in the next decade of business innovation?
Like you just said, right? So the amount of mediums that we're on has duplicated, not to mention 15 years ago, social media wasn't really a thing either. And now we have 3.8 billion social media pages, all putting out content all the time. So if you felt like, my father used to call it the clutter factor, people see 40,000 commercial messages a day. If that was just, if just businesses were able to put out their message, just on Facebook alone, 4 years ago, there were 3 million advertisers. Today, there are 9 million advertisers. So the B2B landscape of commercial messages has tripled. And then on top of that, you have another couple billion people putting out messages every single day. The amount of clutter factor has gotten so intense that people today have to get hyper focused on who their ideal buyer is, because the biggest mistake that companies make, and it's the biggest misconception too, they think they know who they're marketing to, but with just a couple of questions, I recognize very quickly, and my staff realize that majority of businesses don't know who they're speaking to. And when you speak to everyone, you speak to no one.
Exactly.
So the more that you can focus in on exactly who your dream buyer is, your best buyers, and then when you can speak to them directly, then it pierces through all of that clutter. You can't just be vanilla today. You can't just put out a message about you and how great you are. You have to get in the shoes of your prospect. You have to understand what they're talking about at their dinner table, what they're talking about on their Monday morning meeting with all of their staff. You have to know what are the problems that they're facing on a day-to-day basis. Because if you can speak to their pain better than they can articulate themselves, they believe that you have the solution. So messaging is critical in that, but you have to know who you're speaking to first. So it's getting hyper-focused. So when you get hyper-focused, then it's just as my father taught, right? Mastery isn't about doing 4,000 different things. It's about doing 12 things 4,000 times. So just refining who is that best buyer? What is the education-based marketing I'm going to do to them to build that trust and respect? And then where am I going to give that message so that they get it the best? Because we're on double the amount of mediums today. And so much of it is just a waste of time and effort because so many businesses put their message out on a place. I had a client that spent $1 million a year on trade shows, $1 million. And when we did an audit, we realized that they'd only generated $70,000 the last time that they did that trade show.
Wow.
And it was because they were so used to doing this trade show all the time, they forgot to even care about checking if there was an ROI. So wherever your message is it where your ideal decision makers are?
I can't stop but think, I just got an email from people, or I'm getting emails from people who want me to advertise on TikTok and start amplifying my brand on TikTok. And I'm thinking, that's not my demographic. How do I communicate a message? And then I just I'm in the process of purchasing a house and just saw a young woman, 24, 26 years old, just purchased a $4 million house in Pacific Palisades. And she had 61 million views of her 10-second TikTok video, which was lip-synced. And there was like nothing to it. And I'm thinking she's the third most watched TikTok person. Is she going into the market thinking about who her ideal audience is, or did she just, is this just a stroke of genius? Is TikTok really a medium for the, for coaches to sell their work to business owners? There's a certain sense of craziness that's taken over with some of this. And it makes me pause to think, what do I really know sometimes?
It's brilliant because now you can own, you're like your own media and publishing company, right?
Right.
So that is magnificent. But what's missing from so many, right? The number one job that high schoolers want to have today is to become an influencer.
Yes,
that is
amazing.
Their aspirational goal. And I hate to break it to you, but majority of influencers don't make money. Likes and follows don't pay the bills. So it is still critical to go back to that, the basics, like what I just gave you is the ultimate sales machine framework, right? You have to know your goal. You have to know who you're speaking to, your dream clients. You have to know what to say with education-based marketing. And then you have to know where to put it to deploy that. We call it the 7 months of marketing. So if you have a sound strategy behind it, then yeah, it's great if you can get some organic reach and you can grow quickly if you have all of that in place. Majority have followers and likes and comments, but it's like you're saying, it's a 10-second voiceover that doesn't do anything. Yeah. I have an intern, Luke Aberle. He's had hundreds of thousands of views on his videos too. And it just, and he's 14. And there's just no rhyme or reason to it. Like he has one where it plays music and it's him putting like WD-40 on his tractor or his little, I don't know the word, but it's bizarre.
All right. So we digressed into nonsense. Let's talk about some of the basics of the of Chet's concepts, the time management secrets of billionaires. Let's start with that. 5 steps to increase your productivity by 100%. What are some of those time management secrets? I always talk about the Ivy Lee method. You're probably familiar with that. Focus on your priorities. Ivy Lee was a consultant to Charles Schwab, owner of Bethlehem Steel, back in the 20s and 30s, and went in and worked with his executives and said, I'll work with your guys. Just let me spend a few minutes with each of them, see how they're performing, what they're doing. And what he told them to do was write down your top 5 priorities for tomorrow. Prioritize them and then focus on them one at a time until you finish the first one, then go to the second one, et cetera. Do that at the end of the day, rinse and repeat, and do that for 3 months. And at the end of 3 months, Charles Schwab sent him Ivy Lee a check for $35,000, which would be about $500,000 today. Yeah. This is, I'm sure, a secret. I don't recall if it's in Chet's book. I imagine it is. Brian Tracy talks about it. Tons of people talk about this, but what are some of yours?
Yes. So there's a lot of similarities. So many people have heard of time management secrets. There's a difference between hearing and doing.
Right. Of course.
So the practice is something that can take 5 to 10 minutes a day, but it's just discipline all day to make sure. And my father had a problem when he was working for billionaire Charlie Munger, co-chairman of Berkshire Hathaway.
Oh, I didn't know he worked for him. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. He doubled the sales of 9 different companies for Charlie, all within 12 to 15 months. And multiple companies doubled several years in a row. And so he was working nights and weekends and every moment. He had not a minute to break. He would be at the office and all it would be, hey, got a minute? And then a got a minute meeting would break out. And so he was so reactive in his day to day that he had no time to be proactive and actually get the work done that he needed to get done. So that's why he would bring the work home and do it on nights and on the weekends. So he was going crazy and he was looking at all these seminars and they'd be like, okay, now you need to track everything that you're doing. And then you need to record this. And he's, if I had that amount of time, do that amount of work, I wouldn't be here looking for time management. So then he developed a system where the first step was touch it once. If how many times you actually, it's the equivalent of a week's vacation, the amount of time that we reread information. So you read an email, you go, oh, okay, I'd like to respond to that. You put it away. You read it again. The first time that you read an email, you need to respond in some way. Either you respond and say, this is too much to respond to now. Let's discuss it in our weekly meeting. You can put it into a folder and you're taking action on it, that this is something I'm going to do later. So there's some type of action that happens. That's the first step. Touch it once. Right. The second step is to list your top six. So like you're saying, you don't want a ton, because if you have 24, then you'll just happily check off and get that dopamine hit that you've checked something off of your list, but it's not the ones that are most important. So at least the top six. Then the third step is to actually take those top six and insert them into your calendar. So let's say you start at 9 a.m. From 9 to 9:30, you're not going to check your email because you know that will derail you from everything else that you have to get done today. So what's the most important thing you need to get done? Do that from 9:30 to 10:30 while you're sending out a contract, because that's the most important thing. You've got to get that proposal out. Then from 10:30 to 11, you're saving time in your day to be reactive. You're being proactive about your reactive time. So if somebody comes and says, hey, I have a fire, I need to talk to you. Okay, my got a minute meetings are happening from 10:30 to 11. You can come back at that time. Or if a fire happens with a client and you need to handle it, you have specific time allocated for those fires, or to check your email, or today checking social media if that's part of your business that you're interacting there. So that reactive time becomes proactive time, and you've scheduled in. So before you even started your day, I'll do it so often where when I'm filling in the things that are priorities, I'll realize that I had six things. I filled in the four things that I wanted in the schedule and realized that the two that are most important, I couldn't even fit into my day. So then I'll have to reorganize them, right? Because you have to get your biggest priorities done first. So it helps you set up the expectation of your day before you've started, so that at the end of, you already know, okay, I can accomplish these things. I'm not going to be able to get all my top six, but I can get the three most that are important because of my schedule today. So then you have a better expectation of what needs to get done. So by the end of the day, you feel so much more fulfilled that you've completed the thing that you were looking to achieve. So step one, touch it once. Step two, top six. Step three, where are the putting them into the amount of time. So I'm going to take 45 minutes for this. I'm going to take an hour and a half for this. You're chunking down different things that are longer projects. Okay, I can only do an hour and a half of that today. Then step number four is prioritizing them into your schedule. And then step five is, will it hurt me if I throw this away? Because 80% of files that we file away are never referred to again. So that's for all the hoarders on the call.
I like that one. That's my favorite. I hadn't heard that one. Some of these are reminiscent of David Allen's Getting Things Done, which I read many years ago. And I think these are practices that I practice, probably not being as driven as Chet, I'm sure, which is so interesting to learn that he was an aspiring Hollywood guy doing all this other work on the side. You'd think that the book and what he was doing in his workshops and work with Tony Robbins in his late in his career, you'd think that'd be enough. But I guess it wasn't enough for him. So pretty amazing. But I think that's great. I love that last one about throwing things away, because it is hard to throw things away. You want to hang on to them, and there's really no use to them. All right. Let's talk about some of your thoughts and Chet's thoughts on doubling sales. You have one of the things that you have, I think, is the fastest, least expensive way to double sales.
Yes.
I think you call it the Dream 100. What is that all about?
Yes. So this one strategy has doubled the sales for more companies than any other. The Dream 100 was invented when my father was first given a list by Charlie. He was given a list of 2,200 advertisers. He was selling, or companies, he was selling advertising in a newspaper. Mm-hmm. They gave him 2,200 and they said, okay, go cold call these 2,200. He looked at the list and went, that's a lot of cold calls. So he did some research and he analyzed and he realized that 95% of the marketplace was purchased by only 167 of those 2,200. So instead of going after all of them, that spray and pray, he led an intensive Dream 100 effort. That's where Dream 100 was invented, but it was a Dream 167. So at that time, he led, it was very focused. So one week he'd send out a direct mail piece. The next week he'd follow up with a cold call. The next week he'd follow up with an email. Then he'd just send another direct mail piece. And every single week he was in their face, in their place, in their space. He'd send a fax, right? So this was all the things that were available to him at that time. Today, Dream 100 has a whole new life and I can share if you want stories about how we can do this on social media today. But at that time, so the first 4 months, he got not one contract. So people started to talk around the office. This is the great sales guy and he can't even close a barn door. Like, what are we doing here? But they were the biggest, best clients possible. So in the fifth month, he closed the largest contract that the industry had ever seen. It was Xerox. And he brought them in. And then because of that, all the others he had worked on, he got a 28 more. That doubled their sales right there. And every year they continued this Dream 100. That's how they doubled multiple years consecutively in multiple different companies. And Charlie actually called him into his office and said, "Chet, I have never seen businesses double multiple years consecutively. You sure we're not lying, cheating, or stealing?"
That's great.
He actually had to ask my father because of the growth. And that's coming from a billionaire. So that's fairly impressive. The Dream 100, in its core, in its essence, and for those that are listening, I recommend writing this one down. There are always a smaller number of better buyers than there are all buyers. That means marketing and selling to them is cheaper than marketing and selling to all buyers. I can give an example of somebody that recently went through one of my boot camps as well. Would that be helpful?
Sure. Let's hear it.
Troy Aberle went through my boot camp last year, and he had been studying the Dream 100 concept for many years. And he himself personally, one-on-one, has sold over $500 million using the Dream 100 concept. He was the most profitable sales rep out of all of John Deere back in 2017, because he was getting triple to quadruple the amount for every buyer because he followed this method. So if you want more profitable clients, it's a great method to follow. So he actually, we took an educational approach to how he used his messaging, and he went to four of his past clients or past prospects that had all said no to him. And he led with an education. And in the first 6 weeks, since the start of my training that I was doing for him, 6 weeks later, he generated $8.4 million from four clients. Then after another 7 months, he generated $42 million in total, and it cost him less than $50,000 in marketing budget, which is about the ROI on that is about 83,000%.
Wow. Now, what happens if you don't have a list to start with and you don't know, you take a business like mine, right? I'm coaching family-owned businesses. Now, it's not easy to identify and develop a list of family-owned businesses. Of course, I could find the largest family-owned businesses, but those are not my prospects. So you end up, and I think a lot of coaches do this, they end up marketing to the world, trying to communicate and educate and use a sort of a pull-through marketing strategy, but you don't have a list.
So there's a couple of different ways. One would be to go back to all of your clients that you currently have, and I would ask them, who are the influencers that they follow online? Mm-hmm. Are there any associations, clubs, Facebook groups, LinkedIn groups that are where family businesses congregate? Mm-hmm. I would also ask them, where do they spend their time online? So I'd be curious, do the clients that you have spend time on TikTok? Ask them, because if they're there, the chances of the others being there is more probable. But if they're not, then you've already used your use case. So I bet you asking them, they would be able to identify at least some kind of association. I know that there's associations out there. So if they don't tell you, then I would go and start researching what are masterminds that are based on family-owned businesses? Are there publications based on family-owned businesses? Are there Facebook groups on family-owned businesses? I'm sure they're out there because there's no use for freaking everything.
Yeah.
Stay-at-home moms that have decided to run businesses that sell jewelry. It's like, okay. So yeah, I would go to the influencer of your decision makers. That's how I would do the Dream 100. So you'd identify maybe, my father taught Dream 100 because of all of the mess out there today. I even try to get people, what is your dream one? What is one relationship that would change the course and direction of your world? And for me last year, the most influential one I had was I spoke at HubSpot. That one speaking engagement of the 600 that were in the room, 500 of them opted into what I was offering for free. right then and there, I got 100 appointments made, and I've made hundreds of thousands of dollars just in the first year. I'm sure over the next 3 years, I'll probably generate a couple million dollars from that one engagement, relationship.
So good.
So who is the leveraged one that can get you the many? That would be your dream. And it can be, I call it a target 12. It could just be a target 12. It could be a target three. I have three that are most important to me at the moment. It depends on the different verticals, but yeah, I do have a dream three list.
That's great. Awesome. Little plug, shameless plug here. I will be speaking and sponsoring the Capital Regions Family Business Conference up in Sacramento on May 8th and 9th, and speaking to 300 folks at the Generations Conference, which is going to be filled with next generation leaders, giving out a copy of my book, and looking forward to it because it's going to be a game show style presentation, talking about the importance of playbooks, which I think is the new buzzword for a sales playbook, a marketing playbook, a business playbook. It's a strategy. And I think Chet's book, your book with co-authored with Chet, or however you term it, is essentially an amazing playbook. And it's no wonder it was called the ultimate sales Bible, but it's so beyond selling, I think, because it got into marketing, it got into time management, such good stuff. And Amanda, it's really exciting to have you as a guest on my show. I'm just in awe of your whole, your succession story, your energy, your enthusiasm. So I have a really simple question. Your guru, she a fan or a follower? She's had an amazing
strategies?
Yeah. No, of course not. But she's had an amazing influence. It's almost huge. Like she's like another, like a parent or a mentor to you. And I think it speaks to the concept of, if you're going to be a disruptive successor, if you're truly going to take the business in 2 to 10x your family's business, or you step into any business as an entrepreneurial leader and you're going to 2 to 10x that business, you have to disrupt the status quo. You have to bring something new. You have to reinvent the product or service or upgrade it. You've got to obviously leverage technology. Marketing methods, like you've talked about, have changed. So there's so much that comes into play. So is there a single piece or several pieces of advice you might give a disruptive successor, a wannabe person who's wants to take over the family business? Maybe the parent or predecessor is holding on to the baton too tightly to let go. Or maybe they've just stepped into it and it was unexpected and here they are. Any advice you'd give them?
Ask a lot of questions. Be humble and willing to learn. Honor what has come before you. Recognize that it has been successful because of aspects, and highlight those aspects and hold them true and dear. Recognize that you are a completely different person from the person that brought it to where it is. And what are your strengths and how can you work towards them? And it is a transition and it takes time to bring something from what it was to what it can be. So at first, I used to really honor the people that my father respected and put around him, and I held them on a pedestal. And what I've come to find over time is that my father was a fighter. He was from the Bronx. He had nothing. He got kicked out when he was 16 and he had to fend for himself, and he made an empire. I did not have that chip on my shoulder. My father gave me anything I needed to be able to get done what I needed to get done. So because of his support, I produced 4 records. I was able to go on tour. Like, I had the same determination, but he already provided me with the resources to be able to make that happen. So it was a very different energy. So he surrounded himself with people that would argue with him because he liked to fight. He was a fighter. I am a lover. I don't like to fight at all. So I found it very disturbing when I tried to interact with his team. And it took me 6 to 7 years of being CEO to really hone in on what is my culture? And honoring those that came before and recognizing some that could stay, but then also seeing that this is the way that I'm going to have to continue this business because my father's no longer here. So we still teach the same methodology. It's just the intention is a little bit different. He did everything in pressure. I'm not going to do it in pressure. I had to change our methodology from double your sales. I'm sorry, if doubling your sales is going to kill you, if it's going to make you sick, if you're not going to be able to have time with your family because of that, I'm not interested in it. Our mission is to simplify growth so that it's easy and effortless for leaders so that they can have longevity in their lives and experience an abundance that is holistic. And so everything I do is, how do we simplify? How do we make this easy, as easy as possible? My culture has changed dramatically in the people that I surround myself with. I'm very collaborative. I recognize that I am the youngest one in the room majority of the time. I'm surrounded by baby boomers in my clientele, who I speak to when I'm on stages, in my staff, and that's okay. And I don't have to have all the answers because I don't. My father innovated his way through it. He had all the reps. I don't have those reps. So I have to rely on my team and I have to be inquisitive and I have to ask the questions. But at the end of the day, it's still my intuition to make those decisions to move forwards. So my culture is different, but we still teach the same and we still honor him. So there's a blend there of, yeah, I think I said it. So first is ask lots of questions. Mm-hmm. Second is, while still honoring everything that's been there, respect what has worked and keep that, and then recognize that it takes time. And then what are your strengths and what can you bring to the table working to your strengths so that it can be innovated?
Love that you could remember those 5 points. That was amazing. So you've lived them and you spoke like a true disruptive successor. I was watching your eyes. You were looking up as you were like channeling, like, what are these things that I need to communicate to that disruptive successor who's listening to this podcast and figuring out, how do I like step into my own shoes and my own greatness? And I love the part about your dad being from the Bronx and being a fighter. I totally get that. I'm from New York. And there's a little bit of that Michael Jackson, I'm not a fighter, I'm a lover type of thing. But like, you embraced a whole new culture in your organization. And yet you've kept the integrity of the materials that you're teaching. And you've just refreshed them and updated them. And you're delivering them you're delivering them differently. So I think the favorite part of what we talked about, or so many favorite parts of this call, but I love when your guru told you about the pressure thing, because I learned many years ago, people buy for their reasons, not yours, and on their time frame, not ours. And so that story you told about the tree, it just put it into such an elegant framework. And gurus, especially from India, who have a lot of sage and wisdom and time to communicate these stories, the power of selling through story is so important. I'm sure you embrace that. It's a huge part of your everyday. It's been such a pleasure to have you on this call with me today.
Yes, thank you so much, Jonathan. It's been wonderful.
All right. So what's next? What if there's some giveaway, takeaway, call to action, what would you like to share with people?
I usually recommend getting the book. Yes. UltimateSalesMachine.com. You can get it. There's a bunch of great bonuses there. There's actually a checklist, the 47-point checklist on how to find your dream clients. You had said, but how do I find that list of the Dream 100? That it's there, and it's a great just step-by-step on how you can find those dream clients. So I recommend going there and getting that book. We've assisted our clients to generate over $2 billion in revenue. All of that wisdom you could get for $17. I don't know if there's a better ROI there, but if you really don't want to buy something, I guess you could get chapter 4 for free, but I recommend the whole book.
Awesome.
And if anybody wants to find me online, I'm everywhere, but I spend majority of my time on Instagram. And Amanda Holmes was taken by some woman that won't use her Instagram, so I had to go with Amandita Holmes, which is my salsa name.
So Amandita Holmes. That's pretty funny. All right, folks. You know the drill. If you got some value from this, first of all, pick up a copy of the book and check out Amandita Holmes on Instagram. They have boot camps, workshops, some seminars, I'm sure. You know the drill, though. If you like this show, share it with others. Give us a good rating on your podcast listening application of choice. And stay tuned for future episodes. Thanks.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.